Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Emanuel Wallerstein. He is a Yale University senior research scholar. He focuses on three domains of world systems analysis: the historical development of modern world systems, the structures of knowledge, and the contemporary crisis of the capitalist world economy. We sure want to spend time on that latter one. We don't want to get too much into all of Emanuel's work, because over many, many years he has done so much, but he has very strong, well-thought-out views on the future of world capitalism. And nobody with certainty can predict the future. You could make predictions. You certainly cannot put a timetable on them, but you can assess the way things are going, and you can judge, especially based on history. These things have a way of repeating from one society to another over many, many centuries, and America is no exception from the past. So, as they say, history does repeat. Or I believe Mark Twain once said that it may not repeat, but it rhymes. It certainly does, either or both. Emanuel, I think we are reconnected. We had you and lost you. Are we reconnected now? Oh, I cannot hear.
Well, I can hear you.
Oh, okay. Now I can hear you. I heard just a little sound, but now I hear you loud and clear. Welcome to the program. I'm delighted that we finally connected with each other.
Finally, yes.
Oh, well, I can understand. Glitches happen to me, and sometimes they can. You never want them to happen, but we don't live in a perfect world, and they do.
Okay. I'll buy that.
Explain to listeners your view on how you see capitalism progressing in the years ahead. Let me just say very briefly, you certainly see what is going on now not continuing in perpetuity. You see change ahead, and it could take some decades, but you see change ahead, and it may either end up as something better than what we have now, or it could end up something worse than we have now. But you've gone into
line.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, basically, I see the present system in its terminal crisis, in which it, as a system, can't survive. And when it can't survive because it's too far from equilibrium, then there's what the scientists call a bifurcation. And it means that there are two possible ways out. The only thing you can be sure of is that the present system can't survive. What you can't be sure of is which of the two possible ways out, the new order that will come out of the chaotic period in which we are, which one we'll opt for collectively. It's a sort of massive choice of billions of people over billions of moments in billions of places. And it's totally unpredictable, but it's something one can affect, and that's where we are in. We're in this structural crisis. It's a very chaotic situation. It means that things move back and forth wildly. It's a very unpleasant period in which to live. In one of my writings, I call this period Hell on Earth. It's a very dangerous period at an individual level and at a personal level and for groups. But it's also a period of great movement. And we're seeing it now being it. For me, it's been going on for 30 years, but it's become very clear to everybody in the last 2 years, and indeed in the last 2 weeks, because people are absolutely flabbergasted by what's going on in the Middle East. And it is important, and where it, as a sub unit will come out, we don't know, but it's been very heartening so far.
You know, just on the Middle East alone, I read your article a couple of weeks ago, and you certainly expressed some possible optimism on the outcome. I had a different view, and I certainly don't know, but whenever things like this develop, especially in an important region like the Middle East, because of the great oil reserves, and America is certainly entrenched in that in that area, and lots of military forces there besides occupying Iraq. The Fifth Fleet is based in Bahrain, where there are protests and deaths and violence going on, but they've subsided a little bit. They certainly could erupt again.
I was watching the TV just 2 hours ago. It didn't look to me like it subsided at all.
Oh, my goodness. I was reading it
but
out.
But anyway, the point is, look, let's talk about the U.S. a little bit. Of course, the U.S. is tremendously interested in what's going on in the Middle East. It's crucial from a U.S. geopolitical point of view, but the evidence of the last 2 weeks is how impotent the United States is. It hasn't been able to do anything. It's been running after the events, trying to catch up with them. Nobody's listening to the United States. Even their quote allies aren't listening to them. And the U.S. doesn't seem to know what to do, which is quite understandable in this situation. Now, you talk about a lot of troops there, but the point is we don't have enough troops. We can't, we can barely survive in Iraq and Afghanistan, losing both of those wars. We don't have any extra troops. Could we send troops into Egypt if we wanted to? We don't have them. So one has to be kind of realistic about the limits of U.S. power, which are being shown more and more each day. Look at what happened 2 days ago at the Security Council, 14-1. I mean, every country in the world voted for a resolution that the U.S. vetoed, although the resolution actually carries out U.S. policy. The U.S. is in an impossible situation, and it's showing up its weakness everywhere, and everybody is noticing it. That is the point. People are noticing the weakness of the United States in a way that it hasn't been weak. It's a transformed world, first of all, for the United States.
Oh, I absolutely agree. It's really accelerated so much over the past decade. The post 9/11 era, where we declared and are waging two illegal wars that cannot be won. Iraq is not quite as turbulent a place as Afghanistan, but I've gotten comments in some of the articles that I've written about Afghanistan, and I wrote a lot about Iraq and a lot about Afghanistan, not much recently, but I quoted high-level military people in the Pentagon saying a month back that it's impossible to win the Afghan war. You just can't win this thing. So what in hell are they doing? They're waging these two wars, and I agree with you. I mean, we don't have enough Marines to defend everywhere.
You have to look at U.S. politics. That's what they're doing. Look.
Oh, there's a lot of politics, absolutely.
Yeah, you know, if you pull out too fast, you get hit hard over the head inside the United States if you're a president of the United States. But if you don't pull out fast enough, you'll also get hit hard. So you don't have much choices. The president has been trying to maneuver in this situation. He's going to pull out. eventually he's got to pull out. Furthermore, of course, notice that the Republican passion about cutting all expenses everywhere is beginning to have an impact directly on the Middle East, because we're going to have to cut that. So in effect, you're getting a combination of people left of center who want to pull out, and people on the far right who are trying to save money and also are going to want to pull out, and the kind of establishment standard view of U.S. foreign policy is getting squeezed in the middle and is becoming pretty impotent.
We know the last thing that either party wants to cut very much is the sacrosanct military budget. Both Democrats.
Yeah. It's true, but you know, you have to combine the people who are on the right, who are really serious about cutting, are saying we got to cut some of the military, and then there is a sneaking element of isolationism that's being revived on the right in the United States, which is also playing into this. All right, if they don't love us, come back to the U.S. and we'll dig in here. So it's perfectly true that somebody like Senator McCain is still hip-hop for military action here, there, and everywhere, but it's getting to be a less popular view within the Republican Party. And it's certainly getting to be a less popular view within the Democratic Party. I mean, the fact is that 20 years ago, it was sacrosanct. Even 5 years ago, it was pretty sacrosanct. I don't think it is anymore. And I think we're going to see some real cutbacks on the military. I was reading today or yesterday in the Washington Post, Mandelbaum. Mandelbaum is a typical standard, establishment analyst. And he was saying, well, we got to be realistic. The U.S. isn't really as strong as it used to be. Maybe we have to pick and choose where we're active. So we can't send troops into Somalia, he says, and we can't send troops into Yemen, and we'll try to keep troops in a couple of other places. So if somebody like Mandelbaum, who really represents the standard establishment view on foreign policy, an intelligent fellow, is now talking the language of we got to pick and choose, then you see that that's beginning to take over a Washington analysis. 5 years ago, nobody said we should pick and choose. We could do everything, everywhere. Well, we can't, and reality is hitting home.
Gee, they may have been saying that 5 years ago, Emmanuel, but they know damn well that they couldn't do that. But let me throw another thing into the pot as well. The policies, in my judgment, have been so counterproductive that we keep pulling making one bad decision after another, shooting ourselves in the foot. I just wrote about the UN Security Council veto, and
Look, it's very simple. The reason we vetoed that is Mr. Our president wants to get reelected. He's got a lot of trouble already. He's trying hard. I think he will be reelected at the moment, but he certainly can't do something that's going to antagonize a whole segment of his standard voters. And so he had to veto that. He knew that was stupid. I'm pretty sure he knew that was stupid in terms of geopolitics, but it wasn't stupid in terms of U.S. politics. And U.S. politics primes the pump for him and for any other politician. I mean, that's normal. The first concern is re-election.
Oh, absolutely. That certainly is the prime motivation. And, of course, every decision they make, Emmanuel, is politically motivated, as they say. If it's a bad political choice, then they do something else. And if it's a good one, they do it, no matter how many people they hurt, including people here. And but, you know, this stuff mounts up after a time. And it's one thing to get reelected, and maybe you'll fail. And it's another thing to alienate your own people for other reasons, and alienate the rest of the world, and it's erupting in places like Wisconsin and spreading to Ohio.
Well, exactly. I mean, Wisconsin is very interesting, and you know, it is in many ways the same phenomenon as in Egypt, right? There's popular discontent. It's being expressed forcefully, and it will spread within the United States. I've been saying for a long time that the U.S. is a politically unstable area of the world, and we're beginning to see it now. On the one hand, with the incredible Tea Party types, who are full of vim, vigor, but also total self-contradictions, and now the unions beginning to see that they've really got to be militant. And I think Wisconsin is going to be an explosive area which can spread. The Republican governors are trying to say we'll copy this virtuous governor in Wisconsin, but if he shoots himself in the foot and he really has trouble, it'll slow them down in Ohio and Tennessee and all the other places where they're trying to basically kill the unions.
Well, they want to kill the union, and the union bosses are no heroes, Emmanuel. They have their own self-interest in mind, and they have really betrayed their rank and file in so many ways for so long. They're concerned about the collective bargaining issue. They don't care about the workers giving back, paying more for health care and pensions and so on. But they don't want anything interfering with collective bargaining, and their provision in the Wisconsin bill makes membership of the union a vote every year, I guess, on whether they want to retain the union. So they're worried about their union dues, which means their salaries and benefits, and that's when they go up against the system and protest.
But look, I mean, these things get out of hand. The unions actually played an important role in Tunisia and Morocco. Tunisia and Egypt in both those places. And it's the same thing that you're describing in the U.S., but it doesn't matter. You see, how shall we say, it's the old story. I have to get to the head of the line. I am their leader. The pressure comes from underneath, and then those leaders catch up. They have to catch up or they're out. And when they catch up, it creates problems, for the people in power. So I think myself that, Wisconsin is a good sign, not a bad sign. It's a good sign for popular sentiment in the United States, and I think we're going to see some things happening in the next 3 months, 6 months across the U.S. that we haven't seen for a long time.
Oh, I agree. It's a marvelous thing. I am very heartened by what's going on, and I can only hope that it spreads. Of course, this new governor, only in office since January, wants the public workers of the state to absorb. For some, it's a major hit because some of them are better paid, but others are not as well paid. And if you're a cafeteria worker making $15,000 or so, and they want to double your contributions, I mean, they don't have enough money to get by in the first place. So to take more away from
hers. You're talking about paying for pensions and paying for medical care
exactly.
And so forth, sure.
But the point I wanted to make was what's going on in Wisconsin has been going on for the past 2 years, highlighted in places like California. You've got a Democrat governor in New York and a Democrat-controlled legislature. You live there. No, I'm sorry, you live
no,
in Connecticut.
I live in Connecticut, but anyway.
you live in Connecticut, but you're close to New York. But Democrat-controlled state government, and they basically want to do the same thing. I think this is a bipartisan conspiracy against human beings who have a right to have a decent life, and the politicians want to take it away from them. But this stuff has been going on. Schwarzenegger in California. In my own state, Emanuel, the state of Illinois, I live in Chicago, per capita has the worst budget crisis in the country. So we just got an income tax increase. We just had other things handed to people, very unpleasant. And we have a Democrat governor who was behind this.
Yeah, but you see, look, it's very simple. In the United States, we have a federal system with some peculiar sets of rules. The federal government basically can do what it wants because it can run up debts. The state governments, 49 out of the 50, are not allowed to run up debts. Okay, so what happens is the federal government decides, the Congress and et cetera, decides to cut the budget in X, Y, and Z ways. Among the things they cut are money that the federal government sends to the states. So the states all have less money. In addition, because of the economic crisis, there's less revenue, normal revenue for the states. So the states are squeezed. They haven't got the money, and they're not allowed to raise it by borrowing. So the only choice they have is taxing or cutting. And basically all of them are in the same squeeze. And what you've got to say is, if you're going to squeeze, don't squeeze the poor people, squeeze the rich people. But I mean, that's a political issue, and the same political issue everywhere. But the governors are all faced with a real problem that they can't meet their budgets. They just can't meet them as they're presently set up, so they've got to do something. And if they're not ready to do more taxes, then they're going to have to cut. Because they're mandated to meet, to have a balanced budget. They don't have any choice on that. Of course, they can then turn, which some of them are doing, they push it down to the local level. So they can cut back, for example, on money that they give to counties or to cities, at which point they have to, the cities either go bankrupt or engage in taxing. So the whole business of no taxing is only who's going to do the taxing. If the federal government doesn't do the taxing, which is usually the fairest way to do it, then the states have to do it. And if the states don't do it, the cities have to do it. But somebody's got to tax because there isn't enough revenue.
Oh, absolutely. By the way, you mentioned 49 of the 50 states. The 50th one you're talking about is North Dakota, right?
I couldn't remember which one. If you say it's North Dakota, I'll believe you.
North Dakota, the only state in the country with its own state-owned bank. And in the height of the crisis, in the height of the economic crisis, they had the largest budget surplus in the state's history. And instead of hitting on their residents, they gave them a very, very generous refund. A generous refund, by the way, and
North Dakota, of course, is a curious state in the sense that it seems to be ultra conservative, very Republican, and so forth. But it has an old progressive tradition back to the end of the 19th century. In fact, it was virtually a kind of socialist area at that time, though they didn't quite use the word. So there's this peculiar combination in North Dakota of a left tradition and a strong conservative sentiment.
Well, I must tell you this, my friend and absolutely fabulous writer on financial issues, Ellen Brown, is now the head of a private banking institute, and she writes all the time about private banks. She educated me about them and about North Dakota, And there are states in the country that are looking into the possibility of having their own publicly owned bank, state publicly owned bank. If North Dakota can do it, any state in the country can do it. If North Dakota mm-hmm. can have one and be prosperous, in my judgment, any state in the country can have one and be prosperous. Even in my own state of Illinois, one of the legislators introduced a bill in the legislature to establish a Commonwealth Bank of Illinois. Now, whether this will go anywhere, I don't know. But there are initiatives now in Oregon, in Washington, in about three or four other states. I mean, it's an idea whose time has come, and we need more than North Dakota. We need a couple of more doing this and then spread the word. And if a big state goes this way, then it could really open up the dam and spread it possibly everywhere.
Well, work on it in Illinois.
Oh, I mean, I can only dream about this. I once sent a long email to my governor before he was reelected. This was over a year ago, and I tried to reason with him that a public bank is the way Illinois should go, because Illinois had a crisis a year ago, 2 years ago. Just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and the plan they came up with isn't going to dig them out of a hole. I think it's just going to make it worse. You know, you lay off people, you cut pay, you raise taxes. That's a wonderful way to fix an economy in trouble. I mean, it's crazy the stuff that these people do. Each year now, since the crisis began, it seems to get bigger. The new year seems to bring a bigger crisis than the old year, despite all the cuts they made, and they're really, really causing an awful lot of harm to a lot of people. And this thing, Wall Street may be having a party, Emmanuel, as you know, but Main Street is going through a depression.
Righto. Okay, well, I wish you well in Illinois. I wish the unions well in Wisconsin, and I wish us all well everywhere in the U.S., in Egypt, and around the world. We've got an opportunity, and we've got to work at it.
Can I say this? I have a whole hour. Will you stay for the second half of the program?
What?
We have another 30 minutes. Will you stay for the remainder of the program?
Well, I've got a cut now. I'm sorry.
Oh, there's no problem.
Wonderful talking to you.
Oh, it was wonderful for me, too. I hope we can do this again.
Okay. Sure enough.
Thank you very much. We'll take a break. We'll take a break, and we'll be right back.
Okay.
You're listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Hello, this is Eric Ofner, your host of the best jazz show on the air on Progressive Radio Network, Eric's Sounds of Jazz. Every Friday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, I play the best jazz ever recorded by Louis, Sidney, Bessie, Billy, and all the others. Remember, Progressive Radio Network, Eric's Sounds of Jazz, every Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
The shaky economy, peak oil, and now an unstable climate. Get the inside story with Alex Smith on Radio EcoShock. Top scientists find a looming catastrophe while activists strive for change. Experts, authors, and alternative media from around the world and around the corner. Hear it all. Radio EcoShock every Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Listen free and live free right here on PRN, ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
You're listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Thank you.
Welcome back. This is Steve Lindman. My guest had to go. That's no problem. I'll just continue on my own if you'll bear with me. I do an awful lot of writing on these things. I am not a great scholar like Emmanuel and the other people who come on this program. They truly are extraordinary figures, and I'm very honored that they would come on and share their time with me and with listeners. At the same time, very late in my life, my working life was in small business, and very late in my life, I was always concerned about things that I literally accidentally decided to write about. I never planned it, but it happened, and I can't seem to stop. It's like an addiction, and I do it, and I keep doing it. I have my third article already written this morning ahead of the program on what's going on in Wisconsin. And in my second one, I included the spread of the protests to Ohio, to Michigan, smaller ones. Ohio, so far as I know, is the second biggest one. But there are protests, smaller ones in Michigan, in Indiana. They may be either close or maybe beginning in Tennessee. And very possibly these protests could erupt anywhere because, as I mentioned briefly in the first half of the program, the people in states around the country, and the big ones the most noticeable, California, Michigan, New York, my own state of Illinois, people, working people in these states have literally been hammered by the cuts that have been inflicted on them. And the public sector workers, they've had the state to cut their pay, cut their benefits, lay them off, and no matter how much they do, they need to do more because you cut the income of people, and the revenue of the state declines, so the budget deficits continue to grow, and then the state has to keep more of this. I mean, it is really insane. At a time during economic declines, what is most needed is stimulus, not cutbacks. We had stimulus in the 1930s. We just didn't have enough of it. And really, what happened in the 30s, it wasn't just a seamless Great Depression. It really was at least two recessions back to back. And Roosevelt made great strides for several years, cutting unemployment drastically, putting millions of people back to work, generating income that put the country on a revival track. And late in the 30s, about 1938 or so, he declared victory too early. So we had another decline. And he didn't get started right away. For his first 2 years or so, he basically governed the way Herbert Hoover governed. You know, let the marketplace take care of things. Well, the marketplace ruins things. It doesn't take care of things. And Emmanuel understands that very well. The entire system that we live under really is a very deeply corrupted system. It's a system that, unfortunately, there's nothing wrong with free enterprise. My God, I was part of it my entire working life. But being part of small business, small family business, is light years different than the way corporations run things. And before I got involved in small business for half a dozen or so years, I was a marketing analyst at several of the big companies. I didn't elevate myself to management, but I was there. And I at least got a taste of the way the big boys run things. And that was back in the early 1960s when it wasn't quite as rambunctious as it is today. All the companies were smaller. So many of the mergers hadn't taken place. I worked for a couple of J&L Steel that doesn't exist anymore. I'm not certain what it is now, but it became it merged into Republic Steel, a bigger company. And I think I haven't followed the goings on, but I think Republic was bought out by somebody else. It might have been one of the foreign producers. So I don't think Republic exists anymore. And U.S. Steel was the world giant, and that's not true anymore. And of course, the U.S. auto companies were the bedrock of organized labor at one point. My God, there were so many wonderful thousands of high-paying, high-benefit jobs somebody without an education to go to work for one of the auto companies and get a job that would really provide a good standard of living for the family of these people. People without a college degree, many of them high school degree, and they just did fine for themselves. And those days are absolutely gone. Of course, the auto companies, compared to the way things were here back then, 1960s, even into the 70s, were light years different from now. And those companies are shelves of what they used to be. And so many of their operations are overseas. That has been one of there are many diseases that have plagued this country. The consolidation of mega corporations into oligopolies, basically monopolies, because they collude with each other. They have interlocking directorates, so they basically collude and agree on policies. They stack the Congress and the White House with the people they want. The politicians literally are the ones that the politicians buy, and they get exactly what they want because they buy them. They buy politicians like toothpaste. And they stack the court with the people they want. And I wrote an article over a year, maybe it was 2 years ago now, that I called Supreme Court Inc. Supreme Court Inc. with a subtitle, Supremely Pro-Business. And it's as bad as it ever was under Chief Justice Roberts. I mean, these are right-wing hacks. Most of them, maybe all of them, are second-rate lawyers. None of them should be a judge anywhere at a lower level, let alone a Supreme Court judge. Maybe there's one or two half-decent ones there, but there are no Thurgood Marshalls. There are no Brennans. There are none of the giants that once sat on the court and actually ruled the way a high court should rule, according to the law, and doing things the right way, always with the will and the rights of all the people in mind. Well, those days are gone forever. Instead, we have hacks sitting on the court. We have hacks in the Congress. We have hacks in the White House. And it doesn't matter whether they're Republicans or Democrats. And they literally don't give a damn about ordinary people. They serve one thing and one thing only, the interests of wealth and power. They wage permanent wars. I wrote a major article about that. Permanent wars this country has waged. We've been at war every year in the country's history. But post-World War II, when we were the only major world power standing, there was no threat from the Soviets, absolutely no threat. The Cold War was was absolutely fake. not for the Russians. The Russians were scared to death that we might attack them, but there was no way the Russians would attack us unless there was some grievous mistake made somewhere. They didn't even become a normal country again until around 1960, maybe 15 years after the war was over. And they had a brute in Stalin. Stalin brutalized everybody, but he died in 1953 or 1954, so he was long out of it. And all of the leaders after Stalin were much different. And then in the 1980s, when Gorbachev came around, my God, Gorbachev was more democratic than anybody we've ever had here, at least in my life. Well, maybe FDR. I mean, Gorbachev was the one who brought glasnost and perestroika, and he wanted to do more. He really wanted a government that would serve all of the people, and he got snookered. He got snookered by the folks in Washington during the Reagan years to go along with the neoliberal poison that was growing at that time. And then when he got taken out, and this joker, the former mayor of Moscow, Boris Yeltsin, a drunk, an incompetent, he who served the interests of the West against his own people. Hopefully he's burning in hell with Ronald Reagan and the rest of the rogues who literally caused so much harm to so many people. But the only thing he didn't do was wage permanent war the way America does. He had some conflicts, but he didn't go to war with neighboring countries. My goodness, Gorbachev and he let the Russian, the old Soviet republics break away. But that's another story. I mean, Russia is in terrible shape now. They became impoverished in the 1990s. The people, I wrote about that, and I wrote about what happened in South Africa under Nelson Mandela, which jaded me, jaded me, and it still jades me to this day, wondering what on earth can the people of the Middle East expect under whatever regime may in fact replace the ones they've had, if it really happens. Nothing so far has happened to benefit people anywhere. I've written many articles on the Middle East, beginning with Lebanon, because there was a change of government there, writing one article about Tunisia and mentioning them several other times, writing most of my articles on Egypt. I guarantee you there has been no change whatsoever in Egypt, in Tunisia. There is possible change in Lebanon because they have a Hezbollah-dominated government. Depends on the way they go. They have a way of getting co-opted, or Israel and Washington has a way of starting another war to get rid of somebody they don't want, and they don't want Hezbollah except to beat up on, the way they don't want Hamas except to beat up on in Gaza. So you don't know what's planned. There's always another war on the drawing board. But there are a lot of wars in the drawing board. Having plans and implementation are much, much different. So there are lots of plans, and most of them aren't implemented, but they're ready in case they want to. So Israel has a lot of plans for wars drawn up, and Washington absolutely has. And other countries hopefully have their defenses planned in case somebody like America or Israel attacks them. Well, they better. Because especially the ones who've been attacked in the past. So so much is going on that's harmful, and things haven't surprised me in that they've happened, but it always comes as a surprise when something happens now, and then it spreads quickly, and I'm always suspicious about things. It's a fact, especially in places like the Middle East, that countries, I'm certain every country in the Middle East is infested. The U.S. military may not be there, although we have over 1,000 bases all around the world, in most countries in the world. So there are U.S. forces in most countries in the world, but not enough to go to war with. They would need an awful lot of help if they wanted to move into one of these countries to get involved in putting something down or supporting something. It would take more in these places than are there right now in most cases. But the point I wanted to make was that the CIA, that operates on a black budget, once I saw an estimate several years back that put a number on it that was $50 billion. That was before George Bush started raising intelligence budgets. My good, it might be $100 billion now. Who knows? The Pentagon has black budgets, too, that don't get published. That's on top of all the rest of the money they get. So there's no doubt at all that well over $100 billion in black budgets are there doing all kinds of covert mischief. Well, CIA operatives are in every single country in the Middle East. They infest these countries, and there are reports that they were very heavily behind inciting uprisings in Egypt. If so, very likely in other countries as well. It was an open secret that Washington for some time wanted to get rid of Mubarak, but not get rid of his regime. So up to now, that's exactly what's happened. Mubarak is gone. Reportedly, he's very ill, may not be around a while. He's in his early 80s. But you had a military coup d'etat that took his place. So you've got a military junta running the country. In Tunisia, you've got the same Ben Ali regime with the head man Ben Ali gone, so there's been no change there. There are rumblings, of course, making the news, some not. I'm working on another article now. I hope I have time to finish it today. There are uprisings, some smaller, some bigger, in Bahrain. This is all Middle East, Bahrain, Yemen, Jordan, Algeria, Morocco, and even some stirrings in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, believe it or not. What next? Maybe every country, well, I mean, that doesn't leave many countries out in that region. I'm wondering when things will erupt in occupied Palestine. To me, that's the elephant in the living room, because the Palestinians have really struggled since 1948, first over losing their country, then in 1967, the remaining 22% of it was occupied by Israel after the 67 Six-Day War. So they've been under brutal military occupation for 43 years after losing their homeland, and it is no picnic that they live under. It is the worst ruthless police state imaginable, including killings, targeted assassinations, torture, literally is official policy, as it is in America. George Bush made it official. Incursions into civilian neighborhoods almost on a daily basis. People arrested. They probably don't know why, but they're arrested, including young children as young as 10, some as young as 7. And they're charged with crimes. In some cases, often they've done nothing. In some cases, they threw stones. Well, these kids could go to jail, could go to prison for throwing stones. Throw a stone at a tank and go to prison? Well, you throw a stone at the tank. It bounces off the tank. But there's a lot of anger beneath the surface in occupied Palestine. And it doesn't get any easier there when the ruling government in the West Bank, which is an illegitimate government because the elected government is in Gaza. We've talked about that on this program, the Hamas government. They were democratically elected overwhelmingly. But there was a coup d'etat, so the opposition took control in the West Bank, and they literally have betrayed their people, serving as Israel's enforcer. I don't know why there hasn't been an uprising against them. Now, there's a lot of firepower against the people, but there are a lot of people there. There's a lot of firepower in Egypt. There's a lot of firepower in all these countries against the people. They don't have the heavy weapons. They don't have the military forces and the planes and the helicopters and the tanks and the rest of it. The people just have their will. So I'm waiting for it to happen in occupied Palestine. I just can't imagine that it won't. There have been two intifadas. The last one ended in the early 2000s. First one began in the 1980s. That brought the Oslo Accords. That was a sellout to Israel. Palestinians got nothing, and Israel got the Palestinians to act as their enforcer. And the current president, he was elected president of the Palestinians. There's also the legislative elections come up with a prime minister who's like a CEO. But Mubarak Abbas was elected, but his election was very tainted. Israel basically rigged the election for him because he was a guy they had in their pocket. He was the chief Oslo negotiator, the 1993 Oslo Accords. He was the chief negotiator. So he was the one orchestrating, along with others, of course. Yasser Arafat was the key man. He was the one who agreed to it. They were orchestrating the surrender of the Palestinians to the Israelis so that the people on the top could benefit for themselves, but the people would be screwed, and they have been screwed ever since. They've gotten nothing. And since 1993, I remember that handshake on the White House lawn so well, Arafat and Clinton and Rabin for Israel, the prime minister, an infamous handshake. That will go down in history as an infamous moment on the White House lawn. And from that time to the present day, the settler population in the West Bank and East Jerusalem more than doubled on stolen Palestinian land. So how long can people stand for this? I mean, if people in Wisconsin are erupting because they want to take away their collective bargaining rights, and they want to make them pay more for their pensions and health care, then why aren't the Palestinians erupting when their people are killed, when they're tortured, when they're put in prison, when their land is stolen, when their homes are bulldozed, when they have unspeakable crimes committed against them, and they literally have no rights whatsoever? And the 20% of Israel's population that's Muslim, they don't fare too much better. They are very unwelcome in a so-called Jewish state. They are very unwelcome. They're outliers, and they're certainly not given equal rights. Those are affordable only to Jews. As bad as things are in America, what if we were just a Christian state? Forget the Jewish people, which is a very tiny percentage of the U.S. population, with an inordinate amount of power for the population size. But forget the Jews for a minute, and let's just say America was a Christian state run by Christian extremists, and they decided and they enacted laws so that nobody but Christians had rights, not Jews, not Muslims, not anybody else. Well, there would be a lot of people in the country who were not Christians who wouldn't be too happy about that. But imagine an America that way. Instead, we have an America where only the rich have rights. Doesn't matter what religion they are. Only the rich have rights, and everybody else doesn't. Six of one, half a dozen of the other. One is as bad as another. So in Israel, if you're not a Jew, you're not wanted. Get out. And if you're in America, if you're not rich, well, we want you, but only to exploit you and take advantage of you and deny you the rights that you should have. And, of course, that's been going on egregiously now for years and years and years. It actually began under Jimmy Carter in the late 1970s when he began his presidency a little bit more on the progressive side, not that much, but a little bit more. And then he hardened his last couple of years and became much more conservative. So the transition from Carter to Reagan in one way was partly seamless, not entirely, but partly seamless. Deregulation began under Carter, and I remember that so well. It began with the airlines and lots more things done for corporate America. And deregulation, I mean, that's poison, like neoliberalism. That's giving the big boys what they want to let the rest of the people suffer. And, of course, that's exactly what happens. You let the big boys consolidate to get bigger. And the bigger they are, the more power they have and the less power the people have. And the headquarters, the real headquarters for the power in the country is in Wall Street, because that's where the money is controlled illegally, of course. And the Federal Reserve is the handmaiden of the big Wall Street banks. And whoever controls the money controls the country. But they all collude with each other. And, again, they sit on each other's boards. And they work for the benefit of one that benefits the other, even though the one with the money power has the most power. But the militarists do well, and the drug giants do well, and the insurers do well. They all do well. They all do well. It's only the little people who don't do well. In our family business, we sold it at the end of the 1990s. It was very fortuitous timing that we got to that stage in life when we were ready to call it a day and just get out. But we got out before 9/11. We got out before the age of George Bush, and we got out before the time when small companies were even more unwelcome than they were prior to that. And I think if we were still a business during the George Bush years, we probably would have been snowed under and forced into bankruptcy, because economic times got tough, and of course they've really been tough in the last few years. I don't think we could have survived that. And so we would have gone under. So I was ready to march on a little while longer. But as it turned out, we had no way of knowing. It was a very good move just to sell out at that point and call it a day. But small businesses, especially tiny ones like ours, my God, to go up against the giants, I mean, they can sneeze and blow you over. So I dread what we might have faced had we been 10 years younger and try to hang around another decade, we wouldn't have made it. But it is hard times in America right now. There's no question that Main Street is going through a depression in its early stages. I have no doubt that the worst is yet to come. And just look at what's happening. More cuts being talked about all the time. Obama, along with Republicans, have declared a policy of austerity, which means hit the little guys and don't touch the big guys. So after extending tax cuts for the nation's richest people who already have too much, the policy is austerity. And it came out in Obama's budget. I wrote about it. My article was called Obama's Anti-Populist Budget. It's a budget from hell. And for the Republicans, it's not good enough. They want more. They want the entitlements targeted. Well, they will be, because Obama, at the beginning of his presidency, said he'll do it. And I quoted him. Maybe the Republicans don't remember, but I wrote another article saying on the chopping block, there is no question that Social Security, Medicare, that's the big one, and Medicaid also, where the states bear the big brunt, but the federal government is involved as well. Those three programs, the big entitlements, are on the chopping block for elimination. And it'll be done slowly and cleverly so that people, it's like boiling a frog. Until then, they don't know they're cooked. But we're the ones who are cooked. So when are we going to rise up like the Egyptians and the Tunisians and the Bahrainians and the people in Wisconsin? When are we going to rise up and stop this? Because if we don't, they're going to mow us down. That's their plan, to mow us down, to make literally to make American workers serfs, low wages, stripped of all rights, exploited by the corporate oligarchs and monopolies, and America turned into a third world country. And the metaphor that I've used a few times, but you can substitute your own, is to turn America into Guatemala in the worst sense of the term. A vicious police state, vicious exploitation of people, and stick your head up and they'll chop it off. It's coming, unless we stop it, and we sure as hell have the power to stop it. Because if enough of us react and say no more, we outnumber them, and we can beat them, and we can win. But they'll never give an inch unless we take it. It's the only way change will ever come. I say it over and over again. The smartest people I know understand that. We'll sure continue this conversation with guests coming up, with some wonderful ones next week. Thursdays at 11 a.m. Eastern, weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern. You got to keep listening and listen to PRN. Make it a regular habit.